listening to the only daily talk show in North America covering the world of football. This is World Football Daily.
Yes, 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 yes! It hits the back of the net! Oh my goodness me!
The world's game.
Oh, you're beautiful! What a head, son! What a head!
Our religion.
Brilliant goal! What an equalizer!
Our passion.
Go, go, USA! Oh, it's incredible! You could not write a script like this!
World Football Daily serves up the best football talk 5 days a week.
Oh! You will never, ever see a game quite like this! Unbelievable!
First time since 2001, but it's finally happened again. Manchester United lose three in a row as they're toppled by Sunderland at the Stadium of Light in their League Cup semi-final first leg. Atletico go close, but it's Valencia who steal a late equaliser as the Copa del Rey continues in Spain. We'll be talking about their impressive matchup from last night. And there's the World Cup and Thomas Hitzlsperger all stealing the headlines today. But we're making time for a bit of Portuguese football as well as we look back with Tom Condat at Eusebio and his impact on the game next to Spain. Welcome to Wednesday's edition of World Football Daily. I'm Oliver the Juice Wilson, bringing you the news and the many views from around the world of football. Plenty to be talking about today. We'll be getting into Thomas Hitzlsperger and his revelation openly coming out in the German press. Hitzlsperger revealing that he is gay and saying that he wants to further the discussion of gay athletes by coming out. We will see if there will be an impact on Hitzlsperger's reactions. As we progress through the show, I'll be talking to Rafa about that, and also we'll be getting into a little bit of 2022. Once again, the Qatar World Cup shaking things up as a FIFA's general secretary, one Jerome Valky, says that the World Cup of 2022 will not take place in summer on French radio. What does this say about what's going to happen to a Winter World Cup, and what does this say as well about FIFA, who have categorically come out and said that the consultation process around a Winter World Cup will not be rushed? We'll debate about that as well as we continue on the show. Let's talk about, though, Manchester United from last night. Another crushing blow for David Moyes as his side loses its third game in a row, toppled by Tottenham, beaten by Swansea, and now succumbing to Sunderland in the League Cup semi-final first leg. United this season are just boring to watch, aren't they? They are dull. They've got no creativity, no style of play to them at the moment. There's no pace. When Januzaj, you know, a young teenager who's only just come into this side, is the most impressive thing on the park, you know you've got trouble this year. I mean, let's take a look at the starting lineup from last night, because I've got a problem with a lot of people that are obviously blaming Moyes once again. He's having a nightmare of a season in his first year in the new job at Old Trafford. And you think that if he doesn't get things sorted out soon, I don't think he'll lose his job before the end of the season. Let's put it that way. United have said they're going to take time with him. But I think if he has this bad a season this year and it continues this way, next season the pressure is going to be on him all the way till Christmas. If they're not comfortably top four next season, at this time next year, Moyes will be gone. He won't last another 12 months if it doesn't turn around pretty quickly indeed at Old Trafford and show some signs of revival, whether that's in the transfer market or on the pitch. Pretty much, I think it needs to be both. But I firmly believe that Sir Alex Ferguson has left David Moyes completely screwed at Manchester United. They say that the greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing people that he didn't exist. Well, the greatest trick that Sir Alex Ferguson, the Red Devil, ever pulled was convincing people that last year's United side was littered with up-and-coming quality. Let's take a look at the United side in general, not just the one that started last night. Let's take a look at some of these players in general. David De Gea, poor last year, has come good this year and is looking very good in goal. He is a rare shining light in this Manchester United side, as is Wayne Rooney, who's playing excellent football this year and hopefully back from injury and fully fit as soon as possible for United fans. Okay, so we've got two rays of hope there, but let's look through the rest of this squad, because at the moment it's disastrous. Okay, so let's kick it off with Robin van Persie, the big man, the man who paved over so many cracks last season at Old Trafford. Van Persie, though, now having the usual season that we all know and love Robin van Persie to have. Injury prone and not getting the same number of goals as last year. We saw this with Arsenal so often, you know, seasons shortened or ended early by injury problems for Van Persie. And now, after a completely free year under Sir Alex Ferguson, and I tell you what, he probably got pretty lucky last year, because without Van Persie, they wouldn't have won the title last year. That's pretty much a fact. It was Van Persie's goals that saved them on so many occasions last year. Now they don't have him. They don't have that goal-scoring saviour to pull them out of jail at points. That is hard luck on David Moyes, but it is exactly what we know and expect from the majority of the time from Robin van Persie. It's not van Persie's fault. He's a great finisher, but he's also injury-prone, and it will happen to a player like him. Let's take a look at the players that play alongside him in that front role. Javier Hernandez, a player who, when he gets on a hot streak, it looks excellent, but he's not getting regular time in that first team. That might could be David Moyes' problem. When he is playing, it's not with the same enthusiasm and goal-scoring emphasis that we've seen him playing in the past. And he and Danny Welbeck. Welbeck's looked okay when I've seen him down the centre of the pitch this year, is the trouble. He's looked pretty darn good down the centre of the pitch. When I saw him at Villa, was excellent playing as that front middleman role, but out on the wings, not in the right position, trying to force him to play out of place. And to be honest, Danny Welbeck isn't a good enough player to lead a scoring line. Not like a finisher like Daniel Sturridge. I don't think Welbeck has that in his bag. So Hernandez underperforming, Welbeck out of place. I suppose you could put both on Moyes. I think one you definitely put on the player rather than on the coach of Hernandez. That's for sure. Elsewhere, Wilfried Zaha not really getting a chance, so you can't really pull him into this argument because he's barely played. Again, that could be Moyes' fault. That could be Zaha's fault back in training, but we don't know about that. That was a Fergie purchase. Elsewhere in the attacking positions, Ashley Young, diving, not that great. Was made a very good impression at Aston Villa in a poor Villa side. You know, Young, Downing and Darren Bent was a great front three for Villa. For Villa, it's not a Manchester United front three, though. United picked up an Englishman who looked like he was maybe had some great potential. He's not shown that. He's a diver. We know that. And not a Manchester United caliber player, I don't think, in the long run. Elsewhere, you've got Nani. Again, he's shown to be indifferent as a footballer and too erratic on occasions, and I don't think Nani really meets the high standard. That's why he's been so temperamental even when Ferguson was there, being in and out of the side at Manchester United. Not good enough. So the attacking positions in general, aside from Rooney and Van Persie, not really 100%, not, you know, there's no chemistry like York and Cole, and there's no prowess of a Van Nistelrooy, really, when Van Persie is out. Rooney gets asked to do a lot more around the pitch. I think when you look at the midfielders, you know, Kagawa, again, in and out of the side, played out of position. You can put that on Moyes, but he has also underperformed on occasion. He's done well, but he's also, there's been the odd appearance where it's not been great, which will cast doubt into Moyes' mind. But I'm not too sorry about Kagawa. I think it's part of that comes down to Moyes and where he's played Shinji Kagawa. Fellaini has just not been the player that they hoped he would be. That's for sure. Moyes is one signing from August, and Fellaini hasn't come in and anchored that midfield in any way, shape or form. Not able to hold the torch that Paul Scholes probably passed on to him as he left the club this year. Carrick, in and out of the side, a stable midfielder, stable, very stable midfielder. But alongside him, you know, Cleverley in that heart of that midfield. Don't rate Tom Cleverley being able to take over the role of Paul Scholes, something that United have known they've needed to fill for a long time before this year. In fact, they went so drastic that they actually brought Paul Scholes back because they realised they couldn't fill him, or they hadn't filled his vacant position. Phil Jones, a jack of all trades at the moment, not good enough. A player who Sir Alex Ferguson convinced so many of us had the potential to be one of the greatest United players ever. We're not seeing that from him at the moment, that's for sure. Anderson, never been a United caliber player. I don't think anybody around Old Trafford has ever thought that Anderson is a saving grace in any way, shape or form. Darren Fletcher's been out for all this time and is slowly coming back from a very long-term illness and injury indeed. Ryan Giggs in that midfield, the guy is over 40 now, he's getting on, he's not going to be fit enough and have the speed to play at Premiership football, especially for two games in a row, maybe not even 90 minutes at his age. A great stable leader to have in the pitch, but he's also not the Ryan Giggs that we know and love from Fergie's generation. And even, you know, Valencia has underperformed this year. Underperformed. Now, I don't blame that on the manager. I just blame that on the player not performing well enough. And he always has kind of streaky moments. Valencia's second half of the season always seems to be better than his first half of the season. Let's hope that that turns around for David Moyes and Manchester United's thoughts, that's for sure. And then you look at the defence. You know, Butner has come in. It was a purchase from Vitesse from Sir Alex Ferguson. Not good enough. Evra waning in his twilight years, so to speak. Fabio and Raphael, jesters, absolute jesters at the fullback position, nowhere near good enough. Paul Parker would school those guys all day long. So would Dennis Irwin back in the day, even though they didn't have the pace. You look at Smalling as well. Smalling, Johnny Evans, players that we were told were going to be the next big thing, much like Phil Jones. Have they achieved that potential that Ferguson and others kept on telling us? No, I don't think so. Vidic looks like he could be on his way out, possibly this January, if rumours are to be believed. Italian clubs apparently looking at him. You know, this is a United side that isn't packed with stars. It's packed with underperforming and averagey players, really. Really do. And the decent players that are in there, your Van Persie, your Rooney, your Kagawa. You know, they're players that are either being played out of position. Rooney's coming very deep a lot of the time in these games. Kagawa's out on the wings, which doesn't make any sense because they're trying to fill Rooney behind Van Persie, and now Van Persie's injured at the moment. It's just not. It's a nightmare situation for David Moyes, and I think he's been left in a nightmare situation by Sir Alex Ferguson. Fergie knew he got away with one at the end of last season, knew that winning that title was a bit lucky because half the other teams seemed to stumble and he was able to get through on the coattails of Robin van Persie. And now he knew it was time to get out while he could. I still think Sir Alex Ferguson will probably be facing the same problems that David Moyes has at this moment in time. And as I say, United epitomised by the fact that Yan Azai, a youngster who's just playing because, you know, it's almost like he doesn't know better. You know, he's just getting forward, getting aggressive, taking on players. It's great to watch and looks like a great potential for the future. But he is the best player in that United side last night. And people are now starting to, you know, don't start overhyping these guys too early because you don't want to have another Phil Jones, Johnny Evans, Chris Smalling, that lot. They're good players, but they're not great players. They're not United players. And they're not the kind of players that can anchor a title-winning side. Not yet, at least. Let's hope that they do achieve the potential that many at United believed. But that squad, distinctly average when you compare it to a side like Manchester City, to a side like Chelsea. United don't have that same depth. Ferguson knew that. Ferguson left. Moyes is up a creek without a paddle, unfortunately. And Sunderland, to their credit, you know, very well played last night. Battled hard for that, really. If only they showed that effort in the Premier League games, as opposed to League Cup nights, really. They have a few more points under Gus Poyet, that's for sure, this season. Or Poyet still believes that he can pull his side out of their relegation battle. And on performances, battling, fighting performances like that, why not? Well, we know that teams raise their game against the big sides like Manchester United and others. But still, a solid performance from Sunderland last night. Full credit to their victory. Will Manchester City stumble like their cross-town rivals United did last night? They take on West Ham. Sam Allardyce, I'm sure, would love a win tonight, but I'm sure he'd prefer 3 points in a Premier League fixture than a win in a semi-final at the Etihad in the Capital One Cup. A big night for Big Sam, though, because it would just be nice, wouldn't it, if he could get a result just to stem the flow of negativity that's coming his way. Obviously, brought in Roger Johnson, set to make his debut this evening in the Capital One Cup. against City, but still struggling with defensive injuries, with full-back injuries, with centre-back injuries even, and of course having to deal with Kevin Nolan having a very wild season indeed this year. He'll be suspended for tonight's game, it's just not a good week, not a good year for Sam Allardyce. City, the hot favourites tonight, so much so the bookies are actually putting West Ham at 18 to 1 to beat Manchester City at the Etihad in a two-horse race. That's a very good odds indeed. I wonder if we're expecting maybe a reserve side from Manchester City. We will find out this evening. Keep your eyes peeled on the Capital One Cup semi-finals. There's plenty more action. We'll run through some of the games coming up later on tonight, a little later on in the show. Remember, get your thoughts into us about Manchester United, about the Premier League, about all things world football. Let us know. Show at worldfootballdaily.com, at WFootballDaily on Twitter. 310-908-483 is the rant line and the Facebook page as well. We were actually throwing out a few bits and bobs on the old on Twitter last night, and a couple of responses to what we were saying, talking about is it Moyes who who should be blamed for what's happening at Manchester United, or is it the players that should be taking the responsibility? Did Ferguson leave them up the creek? E. Huntley says, that's E. Huntley 83 on Twitter, said he completely agreed with us that that in fact it's ridiculous that Jan Azai, a teenager, is the best player out there on the pitch last night, and that the players have to take responsibility as opposed to Moyes taking all the heat from that. We've also still had a few people talking about who they want their team to sign this January, with Ryan Pine saying that he'd like Hellas Verona to sign Michael Bradley, especially if Janic goes to United, though he'd be surprised if Roma would let him go. Richard Whittle was actually getting in on that, saying that Verona and Bologna are interested in Bradley, confirming what he was telling us yesterday on the show. Richard Whittle was joining us on Monday to talk a little bit of Serie A football. Graham Dowling, a United fan, not agreeing with us on Twitter either, saying that when we suggested that did anybody else really want to win it last year, despite it being a poor United side, Graham telling us that, are you for real? Cop on to yourself. It wasn't United's best ever team, but best teams win the league. So still convinced that United were the best team last season. I still think Robin van Persie paved over those cracks. We will talk about United, I'm sure, until the cows come home this season. There's plenty of other action to get into. Well, as I say, talk about the Copa del Rey action last night from Valencia taking on Atletico Madrid. That 1-1 draw finishing in exciting fashion. But it's time to talk about a slightly sour moment that took place at the beginning of this week, the passing of Eusebio, and also get into a little bit of Portuguese football in general as Liga Sagres starts to hot up. And I'm delighted to say that joining us today on World Football Daily is a man who is an expert on all things Portuguese football. We haven't had him on for a very long time. It's about time we had him back on World Football Daily. I'm delighted to say that joining me now from Portugal, our very own expert in Portuguese football, a top-class man on Twitter, top-class man in terms of keeping you up to date with everything going on just to the west of Spain. It's, of course, from Portugal.net, Mr. Tom Gunder. Tom, pleasure to have you back on the show, mate. How you been?
Thanks, Ollie. Yeah, thanks for having me. I always like coming on.
It's a pleasure to have experts like yourself come on our show and enlighten us about Portuguese football and try and suck us back into it. And before we get into the enthralling Liga Sagres title race and the season so far, let's first talk about obviously the big shock, I should say, of Eusebio passing away, 71 years of age. And just firstly, the reaction in Portugal to the news. What's it been like?
Yeah, well, it's been absolutely amazing. And I think you chose the right word there, really, shock, because he had been ill and in poor health for, you know, a number of years, really. But there was no news recently that, he was in particularly bad health. And so when the country woke up on Sunday morning to the news that he'd passed away in the early hours of the night, it really was just a huge shock. And the reaction has just been a pretty overwhelming outpouring of emotion and respect for somebody who really put Portugal on the football map. There's no doubt about it. You know, TV, radio, newspapers, no one's been talking about anything else. It's a mixture. Obviously, I think the overwhelming emotion is one of sadness, but also a lot of pride there, and you know, a lot of in some ways just rejoicing what an incredible person he was and what an incredible ambassador he was for Portuguese football.
When people have been mentioning his name alongside, you know, some of the greatest ever footballers, and Eusebio rightfully up in that category, the likes of Pele, Maradona, Cruyff, all being named alongside Eusebio as similarly important players to their countries, like Eusebio was for Portugal. But was he almost more Eusebio? Because, as you say, he did kind of open the world to Portuguese football suddenly, where nobody had really been there before.
Well, you know, if you come from Portugal, that's certainly the view. It's quite an interesting, some quite interesting debates. Of course, he was a great friend of Pelé. And at the time, that was really a lot of the discussion was who is the greatest, Pelé or Eusebio, who, of course, were contemporaries and became great friends. The thing is, Pelé, I think, learned very early in his career about the importance of marketing and you know, of the way that you present your image, how that can help your career. And there was none of that in Portugal. There was none of that for Eusebio. The only way he managed to shoot to stardom and global stardom was with what he did on the pitch. You know, he wasn't even allowed to leave Portugal. He was declared a national treasure by the then dictator, Antonio Salazar, and he was forbidden from leaving Portugal. You know, obviously there were some of the richest clubs all over the world who were desperate to sign him, but he was forbidden. So he played his whole career at Benfica, you know, apart from just really the end of his career where he went to the States for a while. And he just really, I think, earned the respect of people for his incredible ability on the pitch. You know, his goals is just over 700 goals, 730-odd goals, averaging more than a goal a game. It was quite amusing yesterday, of course, Cristiano Ronaldo reached a personal landmark, 400 career goals. And immediately here in Portugal, there's quite a few comments saying, congratulations, Ronaldo, only another 330-odd to go to catch Eusebio.
It's a tall order to ask to follow in Eusebio's footsteps, that's for sure. I mean, like all good things in football history, Eusebio made his name at the World Cup in 1966 in terms of exploding on the international stage. Is that fair to say, with his 9 goals, the Golden Boot winner at that World Cup? Was that when he went from being kind of Portugal's, not best kept secret, because people obviously knew about the performances with Benfica, but when he really shot to stardom?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, his that is in a lot of ways it defines him. That 1966 World Cup. It was the first time Portugal had ever qualified for the World Cup. And why did they qualify? It was almost solely down to Eusebio himself. Everyone knows what he did in that World Cup. Of course, top scorer. Portugal getting to the semi-finals. Very, you know, only beaten narrowly by England, the eventual winners. But to get to that tournament, which, like I say, was Portugal's first ever World Cup. In the qualifying campaign, they scored 9 goals. 7 of those goals were scored by Eusebio. So he really did single-handedly, you know, haul Portugal onto the football map on a world stage. But also, you can't underestimate what impact he had at Benfica. You know, Benfica in the 1960s, they reached 5 European Cup finals. They won 2 of them. And the second of their victories against Real Madrid, you know, one of the most famous European Cup finals of all time. They won 5-3. Ronaldo scored 2 goals. Eusebio scored 2 goals. And he was just, you know, just that from that moment onwards, he was an icon for Benfica fans. But the interesting thing about about Eusebio is he transcends all kind of club rivalries here in Portugal. He is really a national icon. And you've seen that with the just incredible outpouring of emotion. And I'm sure you saw some of the images from his funeral yesterday. And his final wish was to say goodbye, as it were, on the Benfica pitch. And so you had that incredible image of the casket of Eusebio on the pitch, in the middle, in the center circle, with the fans, you know, cheering and singing the national anthem, actually. It was really just a hair-raising moment, an incredible thing to witness.
I suppose for Cristiano Ronaldo, he's in the modern day era, he's always played slightly second fiddle to Lionel Messi. And in terms of Portuguese footballing history, could he ever beat or compare to Eusebio, considering the time that Eusebio was playing in, and as you say, transcending the football rivalries in domestic Portuguese football as well?
Yeah, I think only now, I would say, only recently, you know, of course we can't, and it's always difficult to compare players from different eras, and we can't really underestimate what Ronaldo has done and what he is doing. He is also an absolutely incredible footballer. But it's only very recently, I'd say probably in the last year or so, that people have started to actually even have this debate, you know, who's the greatest of all time, the greatest Portuguese footballer. Is it Eusebio? Is it Ronaldo? And I think that's a discussion for another day, really. He's probably at the end of Ronaldo's career, but it's just, like I say, the enduring effect, I think, of Eusebio was throughout the whole football world here in Portugal, but throughout the whole country. You know, he was probably the most recognisable Portuguese individual of the 20th century. And yesterday, when the funeral cortege went from the stadium, which is here in the north of Lisbon, to the south, just near the river, to the town hall, it's about a route of about 6, 7, 8 kilometres or so. And it was a horrible day yesterday here in Lisbon, raining, cold, windy. Even so, everyone came out on the streets in Lisbon. It was all the streets were lined. You know, everyone just wanted to kind of show their respects, to touch the hearse, to say a final goodbye to a man who really made them proud to feel Portuguese, to be Portuguese.
And an incredible footballer and representative for Portuguese football and for the country throughout his career. Eusebio passing away this week. A very sad day for Portuguese football indeed. Tom, elsewhere in modern Portuguese football, we have Liga Sagres continuing to turn up a few something been added into the mix. A little green and white has been added finally back into the mix in Liga Sagres. Sporting Lisbon, are they back? And if so, are they back for the long stay in the upper echelon of Portuguese football?
Yeah, well, that's the $64 million question at the moment. And at the moment, you have to say yes, judging by the first half of the season. It really has been a very pleasant surprise of this season. They've been, you know, considering last season was their worst ever, literally, it was their worst ever season. Didn't even qualify for Europe, even down in the second half near the relegation zone for parts of the season. Just absolutely disastrous season from start to finish for Sporting. Nobody was expecting them to be anywhere near challenging for the title this season, let alone top of the table, which is where they are now, albeit only on goal difference from Porto and Benfica. And it's been a story of the season, without a doubt. You know, they took a U-turn in their strategy and they started doing something which nobody could understand why they'd stopped doing for the last two or three years, which was relying on their fantastic academy. And they start most of their matches this season. They started with six academy players. They've brought in one or two stars who have made a fantastic impact. Of course, notably Freddy Montero, who's playing in the States in the summer. He's been just a revelation. Some of the new players have really just completely exceeded all expectations. And it looks like we have got a genuine three-horse race on our hands.
I'm sure there's some Seattle Sounders fans listening to this who are just spitting blood at at their iPod or radio or whatever they're listening to World Football Daily on today, with the fact that Montero, 13 goals in 14 games in Portuguese domestic football, he's equaled his best goal-scoring tally for the Seattle Sounders. I mean, is he almost, and I don't want to put too much emphasis on his impact on this Sporting Lisbon side, but is he the answer to Jackson Martinez over at Porto, really?
Well, of course, it's amazing, isn't it? Because they're both Colombian. And so there's a kind of a little personal Colombian duel going on there at the top of the goal-scoring charts. But yeah, like you said, I think even everyone at Sporting, to be honest, I didn't know anything about him. I don't think hardly anybody in Portugal did. And he's just been a revelation. He's been scoring goal after goal. As well as scoring goals, he really fits perfectly into Sporting's system of playing. You know, they rely on quick passing, quick short passing, not a very strong physical side. Try to overcome their opponents just by, you know, clever moves and fast thinking and just basically playing good football, keeping the ball on the pitch. And he fits into that perfectly, even when he's not scoring, which isn't that often. But even when he's not, he's contributing a lot to, you know, to the side's forward movements. And yeah, he's been a big, big reason for Sporting success. He's top of the goal scoring charts. And Sporting fans certainly hope he's going to stay there till the end of the season.
Do you sense as well that there has been a massive change defensively in this side? Obviously, the top defensive record joint with Porto in terms of goals conceded this season in the league. Just the 9 so far at this point in the season. That's a massive change around from last year.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you look at the personnel, I'd say both fullbacks, they've played very well. But centre-backs, you probably wouldn't say they're the best centre-backs in the world. Marcos Rojo, an Argentinian, who a little bit error-prone. And Mauricio, a Brazilian, who actually was playing in the Brazilian second division. And Sporting plucked him, and he's played very well. But I think the real reason behind this defensive solidity, which is, you're absolutely right, that's probably one of the main reasons, or perhaps even the main reason, why Sporting have become so competitive again this season, is just defensive organisation, the whole team organisation, defending as a unit. The manager, Leonardo Jardim, has done a fantastic job in that regard. And also, they play with one defensive midfielder, but he's been performing brilliantly this season. And he's an example of, Sporting putting faith in one of their homegrown talents, and he's really come good, William Carvalho. There's already a lot of talk about him being scouted by the likes of Manchester United and Arsenal. He's already made his full Portugal debut, which he made in that second playoff against Sweden, the second leg of that playoff. You know, couldn't really make your international debut in a more crucial match. Mm. And he acquitted himself very well, and he looks like a brilliant player. And I'd say that even as much, probably as much as the actual four defenders and the goalkeeper, he's probably as much as as big a reason for this defensive solidity which Sporting have been able to display this season.
And this weekend, of course, goes into a massive weekend in Liga Sagres after it returns after its Christmas break, although, as I said, we have had the domestic tournaments as well, cup tournaments as well. Sporting take on a slight surprise package from the last two seasons, Estoril, first against fourth in Liga Sagres there, and then Porto take on Benfica in would usually be a game that we'd be saying, well, this is a chance for one of these two sides to get that definitive edge in the title race and keep a three points gap over the other until the end of the season. Massive fixtures this weekend.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's right. Estoril, I wouldn't say they're that much of a surprise. Because they did very well last season. They've also got an excellent manager, Marco Silva, who I think that probably people will be hearing his name quite a lot in the next few years. But they were a surprise package last season. What's been so impressive about them this season is that, as usually happens in Portugal, when not one of the big sides has a good season, all their best players are plucked by the bigger sides. That's exactly what happened to Estoril. They lost four players over the summer, four of their best players. And they've just picked up, brought in some new faces and done exactly the same this season. They've been excellent. They're fourth, and that would definitely be a very tough test for Sporting. Like you said, it's two terrific fixtures, really. That's on the Saturday night. Sporting go to Estoril. And they'll be hoping that the game, the big Clásico on Sunday, I suppose, is a draw. So they'll be able to pick up, hopefully, if they manage to beat Estoril, they'll be able to pick up points over both Benfica and Porto. That game, of course, is here in Lisbon at the Estádio da Luz, Benfica against Porto. And it's going to be especially poignant, of course, because it's the first game since Eusebio passed away. So it's going to be a very emotional occasion. And of course, it's always a huge match anyway between Benfica and Porto. So, and they're both joint top of the league along with Sporting. So it really couldn't be set up for, you know, a bigger occasion.
And Porto and Benfica, I'm sure, are probably not very happy about Sporting being involved in this mix. But how are they going to be answering back the second half of the season in terms of January transfer window? Or are we going to see, as can so easily happen in Liga Sagres, a number of players being plucked? Because there's plenty of stars on offer that are plying their trade, down in Portugal. There's a number of teams in maybe the slightly bigger leagues in Europe that will be looking to steal them away, so to speak, this January.
Yeah, and I think especially the fact that both Benfica and FC Porto failed to get out of their Champions League group, that has really left them open to, like you say, there's a quite a high probability. If a very big money offer comes in for some of their star players, they may have to sell them. Benfica president, Luís Filipe Vieira, said exactly that only last week. He said, look, at the summer, we made a huge effort to keep on to our star players because we had ambitions in the Champions League, but we didn't make progress. And if another big offer comes in for our best players, then you know, it's going to be very difficult to turn it down. It's kind of paving the way, I think, for one or two exits. And like you say, no real lack of stars, I think, for Benfica. Player of the season last season, Matic, the Serbian, defensive midfielder. Again, absolutely superb he was last season. Started off this season not quite on top form, but he started hitting his stride in the last few weeks, and he's, again, back to his majestic best. And so, again, a lot of talk linking him with a move, perhaps, back to Chelsea, the club, of course, he came from, although he hardly played for them. Manchester United, maybe, are also said to be interested. Turning to Porto, I think that the player who would probably be their biggest miss would be striker Jackson Martinez. Yeah, I think it would be a huge blow if he was sold, and I think Porto would try and do everything to keep hold of him. But like you say, that's the name of the game in Portugal. You know, it's not an affluent league by any stretch of the imagination. And a lot of the way the clubs keep themselves sustainable, even the biggest clubs, is having to make these very big money sales, you know, after getting these players relatively cheap, either from South America or from elsewhere. So it could well happen. And of course, that might give a slightly different slant to the championship race. I think it's going to be interesting. Last year, when Hulk was sold from FC Porto and Witzel was also sold from Benfica, both to Zenit St. Petersburg, an interesting thing happened, which was Hulk, the FC Porto board, refused to sanction the selling of Hulk until they were absolutely sure that Witzel had been sold. You know, so you can say if it might be a case of who blinks first.
Well, it's hopefully going to maintain a very intriguing title race throughout the rest of the season in Portugal. And I do hope, for the sake of Portuguese football's entertainment so far this year, that there isn't too much kind of pillaging of these top three sides in Portuguese football at the moment, because I've been lucky enough to catch some of the games over Christmas from the cup competitions. I have to say, it's been a pleasure to watch indeed, and there's plenty of quality young and slightly elder out there in Portugal to be attracting the neutral viewers' attention. Tom, it's a pleasure to have you back on World Football Daily as well. I wish we could give it more time, but we do have to get moving on, and we do also understand that you're a very busy man indeed, and you can't be held up, because we could go doing a half-season review for hours here on Portuguese football, especially right now, and on Cristiano Ronaldo and the Ballon d'Or race. But we will get back in contact with you very soon indeed to get your thoughts on what happens on Ballon d'Or night for sure in terms of Cristiano Ronaldo, and as the title race continues in Portuguese football, mate, if you're willing to come on, that is.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, I always love coming on, Molly. Cheers.
Cheers, Tommy. You're a top man indeed, and we look forward to catching up with you very soon, and I hope you have a very good early part of 2014 as well, mate.
Okay, thanks, likewise.
Thanks a lot. Tom Cundock there joining us here from Portugal.net on World Football Daily, giving us our insight into all things Portuguese football this year. Rafa, I've got to say, I've been so lucky to do Portuguese football over Christmas and see Sporting Porto. I haven't covered Benfica yet, but especially Sporting and Freddy Montero. I mean, did you see that coming? Did you see Freddy Montero and his genius that seems to be coming out in Portuguese football after his time in Seattle? And what a big mistake for Seattle as well. We touched on this on Monday, but what a big mistake for Seattle to have let him go, mate.
To be honest, Juice, I am. Absolutely. You know, I know that he was a talented player at Seattle, but I never really thought that he fully found his feet. I'm not sure if he was fully comfortable here, or maybe it just wasn't that he was playing with, you know, quality around him. I don't know. I feel like maybe in Portugal, the technical ability is probably a little bit higher than here in the MLS. Mm. But I do think that massive credit to the player because, you know, he has kept to it and he is shining. And I would really wonder how many Seattle Sounders fans out there kind of miss him and wish that he could come back, or, you know, whether they're surprised too. I mean, please write into the show. Let us know what you think, because I am absolutely surprised. I knew he was good. I didn't know he was that good. And this is kind of one of those instances, Juice, where you kind of look at the situation and say, well, this situation was just that much better for him. And sometimes, you know, players just can't either conform or fit into the tactics and the style of play and just the general feel for the club. And perhaps that was the case with Freddy Montero in Seattle. I'm not sure, but I definitely feel like the Portuguese league is definitely a better fit for Freddy.
Could much have been done more by Seattle to try and get Freddy to stay? I mean, obviously, since he left, he's scored, as I said with Tom, you know, more goals or the same number of goals in the league this year as he'd ever scored in one season in Major League Soccer. So I think it's obvious that obviously being around, as you say, kind of better players is producing, you know, better football from him. But he was still a massive part of that Seattle Sounders side, and losing him, and you look at the way that they've brought in, you know, Clint Dempsey, and they've let go of EJ, and they've almost gone for name over that quality. You know, they brought in over Fabio Martins and Clint Dempsey. You know, not household names. Household names, yes, Clint Dempsey in terms of US soccer, but Obafemi Martins, you know, football fans of soccer and Italian soccer in the US will know Obafemi Martins and those who followed him at Levante as well. But not a massive household name, but still kind of better known, I think, probably, than Freddy Montero when he arrived in Seattle. As I say, getting rid of EJ, you know, household name in terms of US soccer, but wouldn't probably be considered as big a name as maybe Dempsey and Martins because of their kind of European playing pedigree.
How did you forget his Newcastle days?
Yeah, of course.
I mean, I don't know. Maybe you just are turning your back on your country, Juice. I'm not sure what it is.
And
becoming more of an international kind of celebrity these days. I don't know, but...
Well, you know... Yeah. Me and Obafemi, we're pretty big deals internationally. That's what I'm saying. But in all seriousness, though, should Seattle maybe try to do more to ensure to offer Freddy more to stay in Seattle? Or was it only a matter of time, really? You know, he was playing very well in Major League Soccer and he was considered a great player in MLS before
he was their DP, sure, yeah.
So was it only really a matter of time? There was nothing Seattle could have done about it? Because it's, you know, they've come close this year. They've come close, but they've still been off the pace in the playoffs. And Dempsey didn't help that. You wonder if you take out Dempsey and put in Montero, maybe that story's slightly different this year. I mean, hindsight's a wonderful thing, and hypothetical scenarios are always great. But it's just the question I'm posing out here, man.
I think the only thing that you really could have done to kind of keep Montero here, which probably was impossible, was, you know, bring in an Obafemi Martins, even a Clint Dempsey, and have him surrounded by, you know, a little bit higher quality, a little bit more talented fringe players, not even fringe players, but players. Because that would have really kind of, I think, helped push Seattle over the edge and potentially, you know, make a run for an MLS Cup final. And I think that glory, Juice, goes a long way, I think, in players' eyes. For example,
really, Brett, do you think
Hundley,
it's glory or money?
Well, I mean, I think money will definitely top glory. So if you can't, you know, keep him with money, the best you can do is offer him a bunch of glory and fame and stuff like that elsewhere. But then again, that's probably another reason why he was a little bit uncomfortable. I think, you know, when he first came here, he was, you know, he got in trouble for some sort of like not sexual molestation, but, you know, I think he got in a little bit of a scuffle, not a scuffle, I'm sorry, but he got into a little bit of trouble. I think it was with a woman. He didn't rape her or anything like that, but I think, you know, there was probably a miscommunication, obviously, because he's not really from here. So for whatever it's worth, I think that he was just not fully comfortable here, and that probably helped push him out the door. That alongside, or along with the fact that, you know, Seattle, he probably saw the signs, man. They just aren't going anywhere right now.
It's I don't know if Seattle aren't going anywhere. You know,
they're not going anywhere. I'm telling you, Juice.
Yeah,
I've been saying it for
how long
do I need to say it for, Juice? I will guarantee you they do not get past the first round of the playoffs this coming MLS season, and we're not even.
We haven't even had the draft yet. I mean, come on, we've got a long time to wait.
That's just how it works there. I'm telling you, they're softies.
Softies in general. Well, that was kind of the news from the other day, but this is obviously a brand new day here on World Football Daily. We have mentioned some of our big stories here today. One of them being FIFA getting their words in a little bit of a spin, a little bit of a tither at the moment, over statements made surrounding the Qatar 2022 World Cup. I mean, I love this. I love this topic of the Qatar 2022 World Cup, because all it does is keep reinforcing how ridiculous some things that FIFA say and do are. And all it does is continue to cause controversy around a World Cup that never should be taking place after it's been controversial ever since the decision day, basically. FIFA General Secretary Jerome Valcke coming out and telling Radio France today that the dates of the World Cup will not be June, July. Talking about the 2022 Qatar World Cup. That's what he came out and said. Your general secretary coming out and saying on Radio France, the dates of the World Cup will not be June, July. That is a definite quote right there, Raf. FIFA have immediately moved to play down this statement. It was hinted during the interview by Valcke that the dates would be around about the 15th of November to kind of the 15th of January, that sort of time. Obviously, the Winter World Cup kind of expectation that we've been having for a while now in terms of this Qatar 2022 move, and it's going to be too hot in the summer, yada yada yada. We've been over this story a lot of times. FIFA, though, have immediately kind of come down and said there will be no rush over the consultation process around the 2022 World Cup dates, and that no decision will be made before the 2014 World Cup. Now, more than anything, Raf, does this not just prove to highlight how useless FIFA are at getting statements across? You know, Blatter kind of will talk out of turn every so often on a radio show or in an interview or at some kind of charity gig or anything like that about, oh, you know, it can all be solved with a handshake, or women should wear shorter skirts and play in football, and all these kind of ridiculously ridiculous comments that Blatter has come out with in the past few years. And same this time. It just shows how the lines of communication in FIFA are completely useless. Now, I'm not saying we should all scrap FIFA, we should move away from FIFA, but I'm just saying that this is an organisation that, considering it's in charge of world football, needs a huge reshuffle, clean-up, and a massive, massive dose of kind of PR training. In terms of being able to sort out its story on the situation surrounding A, this World Cup, and B, any major decision-making problems that FIFA have had. It's just beyond ridiculous to me. If they come out and say this, though, this is going to cause a huge storm in terms of the US TV rights, who have been getting very antsy about this whole Winter World Cup idea, the TV rights in general, and, of course, the bidders who bid for a summer World Cup. Do you think it changes? This is going to change the bidding process for future World Cups as well. Do you think we're going to see kind of two bids coming through from people saying, "Well, if we can't do it in this World Cup, we'll do it in the winter or something like that," like as part of the bidding process, as well as throwing that as an option available? Or do you think FIFA will just, once this Qatar World Cup thing's finally sorted and got it all out of the system and supposedly cleaned up, if it ever does end up getting cleaned up, do you think that that they will just say, look, we are having Summer World Cups. We're not going to mess around with this winter or summer or what you right. bid for what you get. Do you think they will make kind of an effort to clarify the bidding process? Because at the moment, the whole thing is in complete disarray.
Absolutely, Juice. It just kind of takes away from the tradition. It takes away from the... I mean, when you look back at how long this competition's gone on, I feel like it's kind of a bit of a slap in the face. I'm not really a big fan of it. I think that it shouldn't be allowed, and I do think that it will kind of spurn or spark a bunch of countries that will kind of start bidding for it and say, look, this is what we can do in the summer, but if you give us a chance, this is what we could also do in the winter. And it does kind of leave a lot of doors open, and it makes you think like, well, what if the Summer Olympics, you know, was picked up by an equatorial kind of country that is just absolutely, you know, deathly hot in the summer. Would they move it to the winter just to, you know, appease that country? I don't know. It doesn't rub me the right way, I guess. And I don't like it whatsoever, Juice. You can never tell what's going to go on with FIFA anymore. I mean, sometimes they are just a laughing stock, in my opinion. And if this does happen, and it does look like it's going to, it's going to be really depressing, I think. You know, it's going to ruin the kind of feel that a World Cup year kind of has. Like, there's something special to the buildup to the World Cup, going through that last season of football, especially in Europe and across the, you know, most countries that play football. You know, there's something to following through with that season, seeing these players, you know, prep, even losing players, you know, like there's something to be said about Theo Walcott getting an injury and not being able to play for England. There was something very, very kind of dramatic and interesting about Wayne Rooney's toe issue. You know, I think it was a metatarsal that one World Cup cycle. Like, things like this, they stick out in our minds, and it's part of the history. And now, you know, it's just not the same, Juice. It's just not the same.
It's the tradition. Part of it's obviously the tradition. You know how us English people love to hold on to our traditions. We've still got a royal family, for crying out loud.
Yeah,
but it's, to me, it's not just that. It's the fact that they've turned... The World Cup, you grow up as a kid watching football, and the World Cup's so pure, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, it's the World Cup. You win that, you're the greatest footballing nation on earth. Like, nothing else. There was no rubbish surrounding it, especially obviously through the innocent eyes of a child kind of thing. It's just, oh, you know, oh, look at France 98. France are the greatest
side
greatest on earth.
The greatest single
wow.
sporting event on the planet.
You know, and to put this sort of kerfuffle and disarray and possible corruption. I mean, you know, there's all
no,
the...
No, absolutely. Not even possible. I mean, Juice, what happened to the rules, basically? I mean, again, and we talked about this beforehand. What about all those teams that didn't kind of, you know, or that followed the rules and said, look, this is... we're trying to do this in the summer when it's supposed to happen. And this is what we can offer you legitimately in the summer. And for all those teams that, you know, came close, or, you know, it's just, it's really, it's not right. I understand that it's slightly unfair for team or for countries that, you know, A, have never hosted it before, or B, make it really difficult to host in the summer. I understand
look,
that.
Spread the game, okay? But, for instance, you look at Qatar, they're not a side that have ever been in a World Cup. Now, that shouldn't come into whether they could host it or not, but...
Right.
They're not, and spreading the game is great, but this will be probably, except for, like, you know, hundreds of years down the line, I imagine, in the very near and, you know, medium term future, this uh-huh. will be the only World Cup that Qatar will ever make.
Yep.
Like, because they are not, they don't have the kind of football institution built into their culture,
true.
Into their sporting heritage. So this is. I mean, it's such a ploy. It's not like yes, it's spreading the game, but it's spreading the game to an area which will not be able to. It won't be able to reap. It won't be able to reap those benefits. Surely,
right.
The World Cup. It's not like Qatar will host the World Cup, and then 2026 they'll be kind of rocking their way through to the knockout stages or anything like that. I mean, if that happens, I will eat my hat, and I have plenty of hats to eat. I will eat one.
Right.
If they make it through to the knockout
stages. I'll eat one of yours too. Trust me, Juice. It makes you wonder, are they going to be put under like really kind of strict rules and relegation, or, you know, rules that state, you know, you have to have a league, you have to have, you know,
Well, I hope so. That's what the US had to do in,
well, that's what I'm saying. I feel like they should be put under more pressure to succeed if they are kind of going to host a Winter World Cup. I think that country needs to be a footballing nation, and not just, you know, like if they're going to build these, here's the other thing, you know, they're going to build these stadiums, Juice, and then potentially break them down and ship them off into another country that could use a nice football stadium. That's all fine and great, but, you know, what are they going to do with that money? Is it going to go back into their leagues? Is it going to go back into the general country's footballing, you know, association? How is that going to benefit that country? Like, that's one thing that we haven't really, aside from the fact that, yes, bringing the World Cup to Qatar is something brilliant and ingenious, but and it's going to bring a lot of attention to this up-and-coming nation, this fairly new nation. Or not fairly new, but you know what I mean. It's just, there's so much to this, like, politically, that it's really, really strange.
Do you think,
know,
it should Juice, be should be
real the... quick? Do you know that the Qatar World Cup has come up on NPR, National Public Radio, here in the States, probably 4 times in the last 2 weeks? Like, seriously, 4 times in the last 2 weeks. That's how interesting it is. And people are really interested about how it's going to happen. I mean, they're talking about the fact that, well, the beer gardens, the temperatures, just everything. Everyone's kind of analyzing this and potentially maybe even overlooking Brazil a little bit, kind of thinking about what is the real likelihood of this happening. And I don't know. I don't know if it's you know, kind of not giving Brazil the attention it deserves or whatever, but it is. It's an absolute distraction, and it's kind of upsetting me, Juice.
What should happen first? Should there be kind of a greater football development in Qatar first, and then you get the World Cup, yeah? Because...
Yeah, or show us that there's actual potential for soccer to succeed in that country on a long-term basis, like there really was in the United States when the World Cup came here.
Well, the US had a kind of quite a rich footballing history. It just never really achieved that potential because it never had the backing, and the World Cup was a big catalyst to that, as opposed to Qatar. I mean, I don't know enough about Qatari football, and it might be interesting to try and find somebody to get on about domestic football in Qatar, but I have not seen or ever heard of anything really being any sort of an impact in world
news.
Is
there a Qatari player that is out there that we should know about? I mean,
off the top of my head, I couldn't be able to tell you one. And you think of all the nations that have got football as one of their main sports. You know, I mean, it's not the top sport in Australia, but Australia hosting a World Cup could be quite good.
Because that'd be brilliant.
There is a football culture growing there. You know, they've got the A-League. It's very recent, but it's still there, and it's getting bigger.
The way they support the Socceroos is just incredible. I mean,
that's a country that has never had a World Cup. It would be spreading the World Cup to a new venue, but also spreading it to somewhere that has a footballing kind of history.
Yeah, it'd almost
and
be like
culture
reinforcing.
There.
Yeah, it'd be reinforcing the kind of support.
It would be progressing the developing movements of football in that country, which is what the World Cup, if they want to expand it, should be about.
Juice, think about it in general too, in that region. Think of how that would kind of affect, you know, the other kind of islands around that, the South Pacific and stuff like that. There would be a ton of kind of, you know, spreading of support and general interest and you know, I think that Australia would have been so amazing, man. I would have been so excited to try to go to that game or to that tournament. That would just be brilliant.
Everybody, by the way, should spare a thought for Juan Arango, who is trying to get hold of a World Cup media pass at the moment. Juan's reporting on the World Cup, but struggling at the moment to try and get some credentials, the credentials to get down there and actually get down some of the games and stuff. And I sincerely wish Juan the best of luck in trying to get his way down to Brazil for the 2014 World Cup. I'm insanely jealous that he is doing that. Raf, before we go, because we have to touch on Thomas Hitzlsperger as well. Mm-hmm. This is big news coming out. Obviously, the ex-Aston Villa, Bayern Munich, Everton, West Ham legend and really was like a cult hero in football. You know how you get those movies that people like, you know, it's not a big movie, but you know, like the Kevin Smith movies and stuff like that. I imagine Thomas Hitzlsperger is like the footballing equivalent of a Kevin Smith movie in that everybody kind of likes him, you know, nobody goes shouting and raving about it, but when it's on, people enjoy watching it, you know? Mm-hmm. And the same with Thomas Hitzlsperger. He was a great player to watch. Everybody loved his kind of pile driving strikes, you know, long range blasts from, you know, 25, 30 yards out. And really was, a cult hero and somebody that nobody seemed to really have any beef with in terms of, you know, fans. When you look at the Tottenham fans, for instance, that were berating Walcott, you know, you can't imagine Hitzlsperger taking any abuse to that same extent. There was nobody that really disliked him. Hitzlsperger has come out in Die Zeit newspaper in Germany announcing that he is gay. He's come out and announced himself to be a homosexual. He said that only in recent years has he realised that he would prefer to live with another man. And he says he's never been ashamed of the way that he is. I ask you this, Raph, because Hitzlsperger is, as I say, a very much liked chap around world football in general.
Sure, sure.
But even Hitzlsperger, somebody who never really did anything to cheese off other fans to any great extent, never really was kind of putting himself in the limelight or anything like that, never really had to deal with that sort of limelight as well. But do you think, had he realised kind of earlier in his career that he was gay and had come out maybe whilst he was at West Ham or at Villa during the early 2000s, do you think that he still would have taken, I think, similar abuse to the abuse that Walcott got, but of a homosexual nature from fans when he played in games against them. Mm-hmm. And I think, to me, the actions of the Spurs fans over the weekend is something that only highlights the fact of how difficult it would be for a player in England especially to come out during their playing time. Can you imagine if Hitzlsperger was down there lying on the ground, kind of holding his knee in pain, as Walcott was, say, down at the Emirates, and he has these fans abusing him. Do you think any of them would hold back from using kind of homosexual slurs at him or anything like that?
No, I don't. And to be honest, it's sad. It's sad to think about that, but that's just kind of the nature of
it's the tribalism in football, isn't it?
Absolutely, it is the tribalism in football, and it's also that kind of collective mentality that happens when large groups of people kind of get together.
That mob mentality.
Exactly.
One guy starts hurling the abuse and everybody else will start flinging it as well.
Here's the thing, Juice. And I hate to say this because, you know, I do believe in it. I do believe it's true. It almost has to happen, you know? Like, somebody does need to come out and somebody needs to have those shoulders to kind of carry that weight, Juice, and be able to deal with that, because otherwise it's never going to be confronted. You know what I mean, Juice? Like, if it's not confronted, then nothing can be dealt with, I guess. You know, it's almost like somebody needs to come out during their playing career, shoulder that kind of pressure and that...
take that burden on them almost
That terrible burden. Because let's be honest, I would... Ugh. I'm not sure I could take it, Juice. I mean, I'm not sure I could be man enough to take it. I say that kind of, you know, a little tongue in cheek. But seriously, I mean, they would have to be able to take it, because then that way at least then we could react to it, respond to it, tell people that it's wrong, show people that's wrong, and discipline people.
I was going to say, it's almost like you need it to happen so that then the backlash can begin against those fans who are doing it, rather than worrying about the preemptive attack that will be made by those fans, if you will.
Right.
I mean, infinite respect to Thomas Hitzlsperger, in the same way that we kind of did the same thing for Robbie Rogers when he came out and got back into playing Major League Soccer. And obviously we saw the abuse that Will Johnson took in that Earthquakes game at the beginning of last season, and how Major League Soccer were very quick to clamp down on that. And we were all very impressed by the way that they were kind of like, we're not having that sort of language on our football pitches. It's as bad as racism. In that sense, the stance that Major League Soccer took. But I do think that in the Premier League, you know, you can be such a liked personality in the Premier League. You can be that kind of quiet guy that just gets on with his business, never really offends anybody. But in the same way when you see somebody scoring, you know, someone like Danny Graham doesn't really do anything, keeps his head down, and when he does eventually score, which is, you know, few and far between at the moment, but especially when he was at Swansea, nobody hated Swansea apart from Cardiff City fans, really. But in the Premier League, when they first came up, nobody hated Swansea. Everybody really respected the way they were playing their football.
They were almost like the doll of the league, if you really think about it.
Yeah, everybody thought, you know, that
everybody was kind of pulling for him.
That is impressive. You know, we very much respect the way that you're going about your business under Brendan Rodgers. And but when, even when Danny Graham would score, you know, away from home, he'd jog kind of past the byline, not even over towards the fans, but towards the corner flag to celebrate with his team away from the goal. And you'd see those home fans in the corner flag, people who, you know, had nothing to do with Danny Graham, didn't dislike him or anything like that, giving him the finger, giving him the abuse, calling him an effing this, a sodding that, all that kind of stuff. In the same way that those Spurs fans who were abusing Walcott,
throwing coins,
were, you know, those people will actively support Walcott when he's in an England shirt.
True.
So if somebody who they will support, they're willing to give that much abuse. Imagine somebody that they're not too fussed about, but in that heat of that moment, what they're willing to say. And I still think it's going to be a very, very long time before we see a footballer in England, especially with the tribalism that there is coming out in the English Premier League. We've got to shoot there for today, I'm afraid, here on World Football Daily. But a big thanks to Tom Cunder for joining us today to talk about Eusebio and, of course, Liga Sagres and Portuguese football. It's so much to talk about, and I wish we could have had Tom on the show for a little longer. Big thanks to you, Raf, as always, for joining us here on WFD and keeping the show ticking over nice and smoothly. A big thanks always to you guys for listening to a show at worldfootballdaily.com, where you can catch us at WFootballDaily on Twitter. 310-909-8483 is the rant line. There's the Facebook page as well. There's plenty of football coming your way tonight. Last night, of course, as we mentioned earlier, Atletico Madrid with that 1-1 draw against Valencia. Haven't got into that enough today from the Copa del Rey, but there is more Copa del Rey coming tonight as Barca take on Getafe, Santander, Almeria, Real Betis, Athletic Club and Alcorcon take on Espanyol. Liga is back. Saint-Étienne take on Evian tonight. The Coupe de France as well. Brest take on PSG and Jarasud take on Créteil. And the Coppa Italia of Fiorentina against Chievo to keep you going throughout this week here on World Football Daily. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Take care. We'll see you on Thursday. Have a good one.
Come on, West Ham.